Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, Zan Brooks hooks up with Leonardo DiCaprio to probe his subconscious about Inception, Christopher Nolan's high-concept heist movie. After the feel-good factor of the World Cup recedes, South Africa gets a wake-up call with the release this week of Rough Aunties. I'll be discussing this powerful documentary with its director, Kim Longinotto. And myself and Zan will be reviewing some films for you this week. Inception is out, Buzz Lightyear and crew are back with Toy Story 3 3D, and the fishiest release this year, Mega Piranha, is upon us, and Zan and I will also be discussing Catherine Breillat's new film, Bluebeard. Yes, it's dreamy, but it's oh so real. It's Film Weekly. This week sees the release of British director Chris Nolan's Inception, starring Leonardo DiCaprio in a high-concept heist movie which takes place in the dreams of its lead characters. Guardian film critic Zan Brooks caught up with its star, Leonardo DiCaprio, to brush the sand from his eyes and find out about Inception.
I'm just doing what I know. I'm doing what you taught me.
I never taught you to be a thief.
No, you taught me to navigate people's minds, but after what happened, there weren't a whole lot of legitimate ways for me to use that skill.
What are you doing here, Don?
I think I found a way home. It's a job for some very, very powerful people. People who I believe can fix my charges permanently. But I need your help.
You're here to corrupt one of my brightest and best.
You know what I'm offering? You have to let them decide for themselves.
Money.
Not just money. You remember. It's the chance to build cathedrals, entire cities, things that never existed, things that couldn't exist in the real world. I need an architect who's as good as I was.
Well, Inception, first off, is something that Chris Nolan has been contemplating for something like 10 years now. And I think he finally, you know, 2 years ago said to himself, I've come to a conclusion of what the plot structure should be. And it's, you know, it's essentially a heist film, but it's set within four different states of the human subconscious. And my character, Cobb, is somebody that extracts information from people's minds. And I'm hired on this one job to incept an idea in someone's mind instead. And this is something that's supposedly never been done before. But my objective ultimately is to get back home to my children in the real world and take care of them. But I've been extricated from the United States. So this last big heist, this big job that we need to perform has great gravity for me. And along the process, you know, I also come across some of the demons of my past and some of the things that I've been suppressing within the dreamscape.
Did it make you more aware of your own dreams? I mean, have you ever had recurring dreams of your own?
I remember small portions of my dreams. I obviously pay attention to things that or emotions that I have at night, and I wake up feeling something and I try to analyze what I've been suppressing. But the truth of the matter is I don't dream as vividly as Chris does, certainly. But interestingly enough, I had a dream recently, and I, again, couldn't tell you for the life of me what it was about, but I was applying the rules of Inception in the dream, and I changed it from being a nightmare into just a normal dream. By saying, I'm in control, I can control this environment. And I know it had to do with talking about this damn movie so much that made me realize that in the middle of the night.
And you only find out how to do that now, at
yeah,
this late
finally,
age.
Finally. It took this damn film.
It struck me that it's also, on one level, a film about filmmaking, that film is a sort of shared dream that we all go mm-hmm. into. Did that occur to you, or are you aware of that when you're making the film, or then does that just feel like kind of hard graft when you're actually there on the ground?
Well, as soon as I read the script, I mean, Chris has obviously has an unbelievable track record of pulling off very ambitious, high-concept, multi-dimensional plot structures like this in the past. It's kind of his thing, and he's done it extremely well. And to me, this was the great combination, the fusion of things, you know, everything he's learned from The Dark Knight and everything that he did with Memento in one. So it's kind of like his 8.5, you know, it's like his cerebral metaphor for filmmaking and his thoughts and all of it, you know, smashed up into one giant spectacle of a film, which is why I immediately jumped on the opportunity to work with him on it.
and I swear it's real. Zam Brooks joins me here in the studio now. How was that, coming face to face with a handsome man?
I had to pinch myself to make sure I wasn't dreaming.
Did you pinch him, more to the
No,
point?
I'd have been thrown out and probably nightsticked on the street outside the Dorchester.
Is he a handsome chap?
He's certainly handsomer than me. You know, people in glass houses and all that.
Mate, really. but you also met Joe Gordon-Levitt as well.
I did, yeah. Show. I think me and Joe are more on a par, perhaps. Ken Watanabe.
Yes, he's cool, isn't he, Ken Watanabe?
Yeah, he is, yeah. I met them all. Those junkets are a bit weird. You're kind of led from one room to the next, and it's a pretty kind of weird, dreamlike environment itself.
Maybe that's just how they set it up. Because when it's kind of a very pleasant experience.
Well, you go to dinner with them, don't you?
Yes.
And on holiday.
And on holiday. Villas in Ibiza, the lot. No, very tough, but well done for getting something out of DiCaprio. Well. Did it help your further understanding of the film? Or do you think that when you're in that junket, they're kind of bombarding you with a kind of party line about the film?
Oh, yeah, they're totally bombarding you with a party line. And you've only got a very brief little window of opportunity anyway. And they're, you know, you're one of a procession of journalists who are being let in. So by the time you get in, they've got their message down pat.
Yeah. And do you think they've all sat together and kind of said, well, look, this is what the film's about? Because, I mean, it must be very hard in a film like this, Inception, Chris Nolan's film, to kind of all be of a piece as to what the film's about. Because you and I will have a different idea of what the film's about. I'm sure Chris Nolan, as director, will have his own ideas about what it's about. So have they all kind of thought, well, you know, this is my take on it? Or do you think someone sort of said to them, well, you know, it's about this is what we're peddling?
I had a sense, maybe, that they all had a slightly different idea of what it was about. And maybe that was intentional on the part of Chris Nolan to keep them all slightly in the dark, in the way that he keeps the viewer in the dark. I enjoyed Inception a lot, but there were large portions of it where I thought, I'm not sure quite what's going on here, and I need to see it again.
Because I mean, I read your I read your review before I actually saw it, because you saw an earlier screening than I did. And I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to hate this. I'm not going to understand what's going on, and I really hate it in films when I don't understand what's going on, because it makes the viewer feel stupid, and the director's supposed to be really clever, but it's not. It's a big Hollywood blockbuster, you know. It's not that clever to keep the viewer in the dark. I think if you can't explain your narrative, then I don't think you're much of a filmmaker. And I actually sort of was following this all the time. Okay. Each level of dream that we were on, and each room that we were in, each compartment of the mind in which we wandered, I sort of was with it. So I was kind of quite, I was like, oh, I'm sort of feeling quite pleased that I don't feel lost.
Well, you did a little bit better than I did then, I think. I mean, I did get lost, but it was pleasantly lost. I think Chris Nolan is the great maze maker of modern cinema.
There's even a couple of scenes where he makes Ellen Page's character draw some mazes.
Yeah, and there's a definite parallel between the art of constructing a dream and the art of constructing a movie, that he encourages us to make that kind of connection. You know, he has the character say, dream big, and Chris Nolan certainly isn't scared of the big canvas. He's not intimidated by it. He really kind of goes at it.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I mean, I remember seeing his first movie on a small afternoon in Soho, in a social screening room, a little movie he shot called Following, which was made in Soho. They walked almost past the cinema in which we were seeing it, which is one of those rare incidents when it happens. And he made it a frame store in Soho. And I didn't particularly like Following,
but it
developed some kind of a following. And since then, he's gone on to Memento, Insomnia, Dark Knight. And they've got bigger and bigger from that tiny little seed.
They have. And now he is, you know, justly, I think, celebrated. You know, everyone draws parallels with Kubrick.
They do, don't they?
I'm not sure he's quite in Kubrick's league, but there are certainly some similarities there.
What do you think they are?
Well, the director is draftsman, basically, with this very specific visual sense and the sort of geometric precision with which he puts movies together, and perhaps also the slight cold touch. I don't think he's a warm filmmaker.
Well, no, and this is a problem, I think, in particular for this film. And if I do have a problem with this film, is that it is what we called an intellectual high concept heist movie, where they nip into people's minds. They're actually not stealing anything; they're actually implanting an idea, the inception. They're putting an idea in someone's head that may then eventually come out and, you know, help a corporation later that is stealing. So it's some industrial espionage, but they're not stealing; they're implanting.
Yeah,
that bit I thought was terrific, and I really worked with it. But there's this emotional arc where Leonardo DiCaprio is looking for his wife, who's played by Marion Cotillard, and, you know, we have to go into subconscious to find her because she may or not be alive, and that she may be left somewhere in the bottom of a subconscious pit somewhere, and you have to really care about these two characters getting back, and I just didn't.
I didn't either,
and I didn't believe he really was pained about his kids or all of that stuff. I thought sadly tacked on to it.
It did feel almost a bit like that way.
Why not just make a heist movie?
Yeah.
It would have been an Ocean's 11 of the mind.
Yeah.
And you didn't need this kind of love story.
Well, it's a weird mixture of a heist movie like Riffaffy, in that it's got that kind of nicely old-fashioned air, like the ensemble cast. Like,
yes.
Really good playing by people like Ellen Page, Tom Hardy, who's kind of almost channeling the spirit of Oliver Reed as the sort of the louche public schoolboy Englishman who's gone to seed a bit.
Yeah, bit Richard Harris, bit Ollie Reed, yeah.
Yeah, and all of that was great, and I really liked it. But then it has got this sort of metaphysical strain to it that reminded me, you know, a little bit of Existence, which I really liked, and a little bit of Vanilla Sky, which is a terribly flawed Cameron Crowe film of just the anguish of lost love and trying to kind of hold on to that.
I can't believe you reference Vanilla Sky in anything other than a worst movie ever list.
Vanilla Sky is one of those films that I think it is a total mess, and yet it does have a terrible fascination for me, and I'd almost quite like to see it again.
Well, maybe you will soon, because Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz are together again in Night and Day quite soon,
yeah.
And the advance word on that is not good either. But did you see the original of Vanilla Sky?
I did, yeah. Open Your Eyes, yeah.
Open Your Eyes, which was actually also a bit of a mess, actually.
It was a bit,
anyway,
yeah.
It was great, but it's not. Pretend to be Chris naked, though.
Well, she's just been married off to Javier Bardem, so you've got
Has
to
she?
Put those thoughts
married?
Right out of your head, yep.
Really?
Secret ceremony.
When? No one told me, I wasn't
Last
invited.
Month in the Bahamas.
Really? Oh, yeah. That's why I didn't get the invite.
No, you see.
Wow. We have digressed somewhat. We've gone into dreamland. So Inception, a big summer blockbuster. You gave it 4 stars. So
I really liked it. I'm not sure it's quite the masterpiece that it's being cracked up to be.
But many are cracking up to be a masterpiece, but
yeah.
Also many are completely having a go. Suddenly that is that kind of, you know, everyone loved The Dark Knight, apart from me. And now people are sort of saying, right, it's Nolan backlash time. That's Inception by Christopher Nolan, starring all those wonderful people. And you can actually see Zan in his check shirt actually interviewing Leonardo DiCaprio, Joe Gordon-Levitt on the website.
You can see that horror show.
That might bend your mind even more than watching the film.
And listen to this at the same time.
Ooh.
And worlds would collide.
Ooh, people would never know where they are. Zan, let's move on to another computer-generated world. This time the world of Pixar's Toy Story 3D. All the gang are back. Woody and Buzz and Jessie and the dinosaur character.
It's a miracle.
And you wanted us to stay at Andy's.
Because we're Andy's toys.
So you got donated by this Andy, huh? Well, it's his law, Sheriff. He can't hurt you no more.
Whoa.
Now, let's get you all settled in. Ken? Where is that boy? Ken? New toys!
Far out. Down in the drift, Lotso.
All the familiar voices there as well. Tom Hanks, of course, Tim Allen, and John Ratzenberger. He used to be in Cheers. I always love the fact that he's now in Toy Story. Are you a Toy Story fan, a Pixar fan in general?
I am.
Who isn't?
Well, you, I think.
Yes, in general. Although I do like the Toy Stories. I think they are the kind of, apogee. Is that a high point?
Yeah, Apogee,
I think they are the high point.
Not the Nardier.
No. I think the Shreks 2 and 3 are Nardier-y type things of this kind of thing. I mean, there is a sort of pattern here, isn't there, that the toys go, they go on adventures and then they go walking and they have to get out of places and they kind of climb up windows and then they kind of invent little ways.
Isn't that the pattern for every movie?
Yes, I think so.
It's like there's that line that there's only two stories that have ever been told, and it's either a man goes in search of an adventure or a stranger comes to town.
Yes.
And the Toy Story movies are definitely the man going off in search of adventure, except that they're obviously little plastic figurines.
Little plastic toys. So why is... I mean, I just get the feeling that this one is not in the original plan. That's why I like this as a third movie. It's like, oh, actually, the other two did well. They make a third because there's a need for a third that's commercial, and they manage to find a story that fits with it. Whereas I think the other ones, they like conceive them as a kind of long-running franchise.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not sure with Toy Story that was ever the plan.
No, not at all. This has an integrity, a standalone organic quality to it, I think, in that, you know, obviously it's following on from the other two films that Andy, the kid, is now a kind of hulking 17-year-old teenager who's off to college. He decides that he's just going to take Woody, the cowboy played by Tom Hanks, with him. But instead, all the toys, including Woody, are shipped off to the Sunnyside Daycare Center. Where they are roundly abused by the small children.
By toddlers. Well, there's the nice ones, the older kids,
yeah.
To play nice. And then there's the kind of the caterpillar room,
yes.
Where the toddlers just go, ah, and smash the toys around.
And then this place turns out to be run by Lotso Huggin' Bear, voiced by Ned Beatty, who turns out to be this sort of demagogic monster.
Which they know, because he's also in The Killer Inside Me at the moment, Ned Beatty.
He is, yeah.
And if only the boys would watch that, they would know. You know that Lotso Huggin' Bear is not to be trusted.
No. Which I thought was great. So the daycare centre becomes like this sort of terrible toy compound, in a way that reminded me a little bit of another film that's roundly reviled, but I really love, called Babe, Pig in the City. Did you ever see that?
That's
the Babe sequel.
Yeah.
Where the animals are all kind of whisked off to a vivisectionist lab, and it is one of the bleakest kids' films that you could ever imagine. But this doesn't go quite as dark.
Referenced Babe, Pig in the City, and Vanilla Sky. Yeah.
Pig in the City is apparently Tom Waits' favourite film.
Because you and him are mates.
Yeah, right. And he was telling me that is the film that he will watch again and again. And it's totally true. It's like a Tom Waits song, but up on screen.
Brilliant. I can see him as he's sharpening a knife on a grinder.
It's full of kind of melancholy monkeys. It's perfect for him.
Right, I'm going to get that out.
All right, get that out. Fest. But in the meantime, Toy Story 2 is definitely worth a visit.
Brilliant. Let's move to Bluebeard, Zan. Catherine Breillat, who is a director who is often controversial, often puts erect Italian penises in her films. Does she do that in her new film, Bluebeard?
Ça ne vous ennuie pas de les voir danser sans vous?
Ils s'amusent. J'aime être entouré de jeunes qui s'amusent. Va danser, toi aussi.
Personne ne m'invite.
Any French speakers out there will probably attest to the fact that they weren't talking about Italian porn stars in that clip. Something much more chaste.
But they were utterly naked, as they were saying.
Yes, that's for you to say, yeah. Sam, but you and I have seen this film, Catherine Breillat. It is a bit different to hers, and yet of a piece with her work.
Well, it's a sexual parable, I guess. So it is very much of a piece. It's obviously based on the story by, is it Charles Perrault, about the Bluebeard fairy tale.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of him, actually, this story.
It's a great story.
Is it?
It is one of the great stories, I think.
So it's an ogre who marries young girls and eats them.
Kills them, certainly. I guess it is like the oppressive love, the contract that you enter into with somebody, in that he allows her to do everything. He welcomes her into his home and gives her a key and says there's one door that you mustn't unlock. And in there, of course, as everyone who knows the story, is the bodies of all his previous wives who betrayed him in doing
by
this.
By unlocking this door.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, it is like the Chekhov thing about the gun on the mantelpiece, that it's got to be fired. If you give someone a key and says don't open that lock, of course you're going to do
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
It's a very small-scale film, this. It's a chamber piece, yeah. In a way. It has the sort of the two levels of reality, that there's the two little girls who are reading the story in little inserts.
I think they're in the present. They're in the 50s, though. I don't know. They're kind of little.
By its nature, it's an explosive story, and yet everything is slightly downplayed. Which I thought worked. I thought that is it Lola Creton, who plays Marie Catherine, who's the sort of impoverished, you know, really early teenage girl who is married off to this sort of mysterious, overweight, hulking feudal baron, played by Dominique Thomas. Both of them give very good performances in a odd way that they're never quite connecting, but there's a sort of tenderness between them. I'm not sure it's a great film, but it's one of those films that does stay with
it's
you.
It's very interesting. I was watching it sort of, I hate this, this is rubbish, and then it sort of, but it stayed with me, you know, all the images as well. And it's kind of a beauty to it as well.
There is simplicity. Yeah.
Catherine Breillat's new film, Bluebeard. Zan, there is, I just must mention a film to you that I've seen this week called Mega Piranha.
No, sorry, no, he's gone. We need to get to the embassy, come on.
Embassy, I'm not going to an embassy. We've got to follow the piranha right down to the river and find someone, anyone, to kill them and bomb them. I just want to kill them all.
Which is about a shoal of killer piranha fish that have, because of an experiment that's gone wrong, they grow exponentially and then they start eating whole boats in the Orinoco River.
Why do I always miss out on
this? And then they eat lighthouses and then they eat villages. Now they're heading to Florida and they're going to eat America, basically, unless we destroy them with a nuclear weapon.
But this is a film. This isn't real.
And the only person that can save them is 80s pop star Tiffany.
I have heard that Tiffany is in this.
Yes. I think it's the worst film ever made. So bad it is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, surely this is an intentionally bad film.
Yeah, but I think you have to strive hard. Because right. There's a moment, I mean, it looks like a sort of slightly TV movie as well. But yes, it is intentionally bad, and the effects are rubbish.
But you liked it.
Well, I couldn't believe how bad it was. And he was like, it was the bloke who was the special ops guy who gets sent down there. Go to Venezuela. These giant piranha are taking over. Get down there quick before we have another Afghanistan on our hands. Like, in what way is this like Afghanistan, Mr. Guy in the Pentagon?
Do you know, I don't think I'm ever going to see this film.
Well, I'm never going to see Babe, Pig in the City 2 in that case. Well, let's do a swap.
All right.
Zan, thank you very much. For more of your musings and to see his range of facial expressions and shirts in video, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Director Kim Longinotto is perhaps one of the finest documentary makers working today. She's won international acclaim and admiration for her courageous, insightful films, often dealing with taboo subjects such as female circumcision in The Day I'll Never Forget, violent children in Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go, African law in Sisters-in-Law, and this week sees the release of her new film Rough Aunties, which won the World Cinema Jury Prize in Documentary at this year's Sundance Festival. The film follows the daily struggles of a collective of women in South Africa's Durban, known as the Bobby Bears, who counsel and defend vulnerable women and children suffering abuse. Often revealing the most harrowing stories, the documentary never loses sight of the humanity of the women and children involved, emphasising empowerment and the positive nature of their struggles. When I met up with Kim Longinotto here in London, I told her that it was one of the saddest films I've ever seen in my life. The film had left me in bits, but in a good way.
I cried a lot when we were making it, yeah. So, and I love it that you cried.
So tell us a bit about, well, we're in Durban at this organisation. Tell us how you found them and what made you think that these women that run this organisation in particular would be such a sort of good kind of subject for your documentary. I mean, you've done Sisters-in-Law mm-hmm. quite recently in Africa as well, but now we're moving to South Africa, which yeah. obviously has just had the world spotlight shone on it, and then along yeah. comes your film to show a rather the place in a rather different light. But as you say, highs and lows in there as well.
Well, it's my fourth film in Africa, and what's so strange for me about making this film was the film I made before, which, as you say, is Sisters-in-Law. I actually went to Africa to find a story and met the two main women in Sisters-in-Law and thought this would be a good story for a film. But this one was very odd because Ollie Huddleston, the editor, and I, we were editing a film called Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go, about it in a boarding school. And Jackie, who's from Rough Aunties, came to see me to ask me to make the film because she knew Paul Taylor and Teddy Leifer, who'd made a fantastic film in an orphanage nearby where the Rough Aunties are. And that I'd never had that experience of somebody saying, will you make a film about us? And I thought, my God, this is so strange. But they weren't saying we want a film made about us for the reasons you might in this country, for the publicity or for the celebrity or in that way. They wanted a film made because they're a very small group of people and they're battling on all fronts, on many fronts. They fight the police. They fight social services desperately. They fight the hospitals because they won't take you unless you pay money. Yeah. You really see in the film why we're so lucky to have the NHS. Yes, so that's why they wanted a film, because they felt that their job is to rescue children. And they thought, we're only 10 women. We're a really small group of women. We've got no money. We're beleaguered. And all these other things around us are ranged against us. And the reason they don't accept any government money is because they are often at war with government agencies, because they will rescue a child and the social services will send the child straight back to the parents. In fact, there's a little story in the film where they pick up this baby who's been repeatedly raped, a little tiny baby, and Jackie finds out that every time they'd found him in the past, the police would hand the little baby straight back to his dad.
But when someone says, well, would you make a film about us? I mean, I would say, I don't know, but knowing you and your work, I would imagine your instinct would be to, well, I'm not going to do that. You know, that's you know, kind of anathema to me. I'm the one that finds the stories. I'm the one that finds the characters.
Well, not really. I was really intrigued, you know, Jason, because I thought, well, this is amazing. She's come here to meet me. She wants a film made. And I was quite impressed by her. She's quite impressive, Jackie. But then I thought, well, I can't just say I'm going to make... I have to go and meet the women and see where they are and do it that way around.
And were you aware of Paul Taylor's film, which the name of which I've forgotten?
We Are Together.
We Are Together, which was an award-winning film set there. And you were aware of his film and his work there?
Yes, and I really immediately liked Paul, and that did help. And Paul and I went together to meet the women. So I didn't just set out on my own. I went with Paul, and he was incredibly impressive. He drove this white van and knew his way around everywhere and was kind of intrepid. And so I thought, wow, he's pretty good. But what really tipped it for me was I went to this place and I met this woman. And it's so funny because she's called Mildred, and she's the, from my point of view, she's the main character in the film, but everyone has their own main characters. But I met Mildred, and there she was in her little black skirt and beautifully pressed white shirt and with this huge smile and just full of joy and love and everything. And I just thought, God, you're one. I just adored her.
Yeah, she, I mean, the sun shines out of her. She's an extraordinary person, and she comes across that way as well. Yes. She was, she's my kind of star of the movie. Yes. But you wouldn't, I mean, she's not the lead, but she's the star.
Yes, she's my star.
Because it's her human story, her personal story, which kind of meanders or weaves its way through the more kind of social aspects of it. So you've got this human root, I think, which is why I was crying, because it's got this story that you couldn't make up, as you say.
Yes.
And then she has an emotional journey that I wouldn't want to ruin for anyone when the shocks come. But it is it's someone who works so beautifully in charity, but then can't stop it impacting on her own life as well. I, my heart went out to you as well, Kim. At some point I was thinking, well, how can you as a documentarian, as a journalist, kind of go into this and not be affected yourself?
Oh, Jason, I was completely affected. But one of the things that I learned from there, I suppose you always learn something, but the thing I really learned and that moved me terribly, and that I think we have so much to learn from how they are, was that I started to see myself as a survivor and not as a victim. Because there's always this sense in this country that if you've been raped, you're a victim. And what they did is they show the children to be proud. I'm speaking out. I'm proud to speak out. The person that's done this to me is the bad person, and they should be ashamed. I shouldn't be ashamed. I'm a survivor. And I know it sounds so simple to me now, and it's so obvious to me now, but even people say things, oh, you're showing children talking about rape, or, you know, you're... And Mildred, at one point in the film, she's really down, and this other woman with her says, oh, what's the matter, Mildred? And Mildred says nothing, and we follow her upstairs, and then she just... And it's not an interview, because I don't do interviews. She just suddenly started talking to me about her life.
And I told my mum, I said, I told her that I was raped, and they did not believe me. It was painful for me that my biological mother doesn't believe me, but a stranger can believe me. She can listen to me. She wanted to know more what happened, but my mum did not. It took me a long time to realize that maybe she did not understand, or she did not know how to help me.
I was very moved by the fact she wanted to speak up and say it. And when you talk to the children after they tell not me, when they, you know, they say, I feel so much better. I feel so proud that I'm going to get this guy in prison. I'm a witness. I'm not a victim anymore.
Yeah, your film starts actually very precedent with a scene in which a child does come out with the rape, but it's done through a teddy bear, drawing on a teddy bear, and a laughing at the mention of a private part, says the subtitles. I don't know what the dialect actually calls it. If you come to the film kind of unknown, you don't really know what they're going to talk about, and then it suddenly hits you. Did you have when did the structure come to you? When did the way you were going to go into this subject come to you?
I worked with this really nice editor called Ollie, and what he's taught me and what he does is he cuts very much like a fiction film. Nothing set up, of course, obviously you couldn't set anything up like that, but what he does is he tells a story. So we don't have interviews, we follow a story. So the film itself is largely chronological, and as you say, I'm not going to give things away, but there's two deaths in the film, and you can't have one death at the beginning and one at the end, because they are in the same week. And one of the women says to the other one during the second death, too many deaths in one week, Jackie. Yeah. So there's a kind of really strong story that you have to cut the film within. But the first scene, which is this little girl who is talking about how her neighbour goes in through the window and rapes her, the only place it could be was at the beginning, because she then talks about it by doing things on the doll. So in the following scenes, you don't even have to have anyone saying anything. You just show them doing things to a doll, right? And yeah. It's a nice way of, you can understand exactly how Bobby Bear works, how they use the teddy bears, how it all works, and that's it done with. And now you go into the action sort of thing.
So yes. they were kind of aware of the sort of films you make, but to be part of that action and to be on call, because they're in the middle of the night, they go on raids, they do sort of many things. I guess you had to live the same life as them for I don't know how many months.
Well, on call is a really good way of describing it, because what we had is we had a mobile phone. So then Mildred usually would ring me at 6 a.m. and say, I'm doing this. She'd say, what are you doing, Kim? And I'd say, sleeping, Mildred. But anyway, but then she'd find out, I'd ask her what she was doing. I would know what everybody was doing. And then in the morning, we'd go into the Bobby Bear offices and I'd make everybody a cup of tea or whatever they had to drink. You know, they all had their separate little things. And in that way, I would go into each office and I would know what was happening. I'd make them breakfast. And so I was part of the team that I would do things for them, but I was also there all the time. So that's why when a phone call comes through in the middle of the film that Eureka's son-in-law has been shot, I know that that's happened, and I know to be in the office so that when Jackie gets the call, that I can actually film things as they happen. So it was nice for me to make them tea, but it was also very nice because I was always in the right place. But then, as you say, things would often happen in the night. There's a night scene where we're rushing through this incredible, African storm. And that's because Thule, who's the woman that works with Mildred, rang and said, you've got to come now. We're just about to go, so we went with them.
We just want to find out Thule.
Yes.
Where's the suspect in this case?
They found the police and he's in the cell. He's in the holding cells, yes.
These other people outside the charge office, are they all witnesses?
So they included us, and that was what was so nice. There was never a sense of, are we in the way? Should we were included in their work. And so that at times it almost felt very, very strange. There's this very awful scene where one of their children gets killed. And
one of the scenes where obviously the tears were flowing.
Yes, I absolutely.
But only because you just everything's going fine and then bang, you just give it like that, Kim. Yes. It's like one of the kind of coldest cuts of all.
But that's how it happened. So we got a phone call saying, you've got to come, this little boy's died. And so we rushed there and we're the first there with the other women. And I never felt bad filming it because I knew that they wanted it filmed because it was a film about their life and they wanted, and that's what we talked about right at the beginning. Is this really about your life? Are you really up for everything being filmed? And they said yes. And that's when I knew I could go back and film them because it's so truthful and so raw. And that's how they are,
Having watched Sisters in Law and then you came back and did Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go, which was, set with remarkable children in a remarkable nursery, I suppose, here in England. The mix of subjects, the remarkable women that you've chronicled over the time. I would say that Rough Aunties, I haven't seen all of your works, but I've seen many. Rough Aunties is the most, I would say, the most moving of all of them, maybe because its narrative is that almost like it's one where it comes together where there is such a sort of, if you wrote it, people might accuse you of sort of saying, well, that would never happen, or that's too sentimental. Was it one of the saddest or most moving? I think it's sad in a very inspirational way. Was it one of the most kind of empathetic experiences you've had as a filmmaker?
I think the thing is, Jason, and it's weird because the last three films I've made, they've all been people who wanted the films made. And I think that's happening now because maybe they see the films and, I don't know, they want films made. But I think,
you're a bit famous now.
No, it's not because I'm famous. It's because they know they can trust me and I'm not going to rip them off.
That's what you're famous for.
No, stop it. Anyway, but I think each film sort of gets me in a different way. So like when I was doing Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go, I thought, oh, lovely, filming in Britain, can go home at the weekends. All in English, it's going to be a really easy film. And in fact, that film really hit me hard because that film turned itself on me. And every film, like Rough Aunties, taught me about rape and how to think about my own rape and that I shouldn't be ashamed of talking about it, which is great. Probably not for other people. I mean, I don't talk about it all the time, only when I'm talking about Rough Aunties. But Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go made me think about my childhood and the horrible school I went to and how it's positive to have a nice school and how it's possible to like teachers. Because when Roger Graves said, will you make this film, in a school. I said, I'm not making a film in a school. I hate teachers. I hate school. And yet I went there and I loved the teachers and I loved the school. And so, and then Sisters-in-Law, it really, why I found that incredibly moving was that these two women, two judges, who were so selfless and so amazing and democratic and strong and everything, and we'd never get judges like that in this country, and so honourable and never accepting any bribes and had very little themselves.
Yeah.
So that was another window into a different way of looking at Africa. So each one kind of moves you in a different way.
Yeah.
When you say you talk about your own rape, is that something you've never spoken about before or never examined on film before and only doing now for the first time?
No, because I was quite bashed up. It was very obvious something quite serious had happened to me.
When was it?
It was about 10 years ago, about 10, 15 years ago. And I said to myself, if people ask me what's happened, I'm not going to lie to them because then that's like, you know. So I did tell people if they asked me. But the difference was I did see myself as a victim, and that was the difference. I didn't see myself as a survivor. It's just a shift. Might seem a very small, insignificant shift. But what was brilliant was when Mildred told me, and then after she told me and I filmed it, I told her, I felt really great. I thought, oh, we both got through this together and we're absolutely fine. So to me, it isn't a film about rape. Rape is part of it. There's a little bit of rape in it, but actually the film, to me, is a sort of a thriller of these women working together and going through all these extraordinary stories and going through these adventures, really, yeah, together to save these children, but also going through personal adventures and personal stories. I wouldn't want to make a film about it because I think it's much more interesting if it comes out through something else. So Sisters-in-Law, you could say it's about these two women judges, but it's not. It's about all these stories that happen that are somehow based or connected to a courtroom. So what I want to do is I want to tell stories. So I want to make documentary Sopranos or documentary Mad Men or documentary ETs, you know, that they're documentary because it's all real and it happens in front of your eyes. But you're not being told what to think. You're not being given statistics. You're not. If people want statistics and those sort of films, then they should go to other films. And sometimes people say, I was really disappointed with Rough Aunties because I didn't get any context. I didn't find out about the political situation in South Africa. And I never say anything. I listen and I maybe write it down. But then I think, well, if you want to know figures and statistics, you know, they don't say in Sopranos there are 300,000 mafia in Seattle or whatever it is. You get into a really good story and you learn an awful lot about it through the story.
Well, I think I learned much more about it than I would by reading a whole kind of National Bureau of Statistics official document or anything like that. I learned about this corner of the world and these people. And I also learned that documentaries can be, you know, some of the saddest and most moving and inspirational pieces of work, Kim. So for Rough Aunties, thank you very much indeed. And I hope that it's had in a good way. I didn't want to put on the poster the saddest film I've ever seen, but I think that's a good thing sometimes.
Oh, good. Thank you.
The music of the Queen of South African Pop there, the late Brenda Fassie, accompanying Rough Aunties. Kim Longinotto's film has a limited release here in the UK, but it is a must-see. As I say, one of the saddest film experiences I've ever had, but very inspiring for all of that. For more information, I highly recommend you read the backstories of the women featured in the film. Go to their website, roughaunties.com. The film is playing at the ICA here in London before it goes out as one of the true stories on More 4 in about a month's time. Thanks to Kim Longinotto there, and to all my guests this week. The music featured throughout the podcast is taken from the score to Inception by Hans Zimmer. If you want the best film news and reviews, do pick up The Observer this Sunday. There you'll find my trailer trash column, of course. But for now, until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and from my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.